Thanks, Rachel. Thanks to all the organizers for the chance to be here and talk to you and to learn a lot. It's only my name up there, but I work with a lot of people and benefit from talking to a lot of people, so they'll try to hit all them during the talk at the appropriate time. It'll be something old, something new. Some of the new is like last week, so I feel like in the second half of the talk, I'm showing you my notebook, basically. So for better or worse, that's what you're getting. So some of the introductory material will look very familiar since you and I read the same sources. We've been talking quite a while. So the tear film is a multi-layer structure that has to reestablish itself after each blink. It needs to establish itself reasonably rapidly, like within a second or two. This happens every few seconds normally, I think, when you're not really thinking about anything. But I guarantee you, if you're playing a video game or working on your talk late at night, you are blinking much less often than that. So it varies widely depending on what you're doing. Within the structure that needs to be established after a blink includes a floating lipid layer, which looks like it's truncated here, and primarily aqueous layer that has a bunch of stuff in it, which includes mucins, salts, and other stuff, lots of things in there. At the surface of the eye itself, on the cornea, it's a relatively smooth surface with small microplicae, I guess they're called, or microvilli, depending on how you like to say it, but I'm used to saying plicae. And there's mucins sticking up out of that like a forest, or like kelp is the word that's often used to describe that. And these things have multiple functions. They lubricate the surface during a blink. They help lubricate it. They keep the surface wet. They attract water. They're mucins, so they have a lot of sugars on them. And so they suck water to them. And they also break off, so if there's a foreign object that shouldn't be there, they can often stick to this thing and then break off, and then this, whatever it is, gets transported away. So in a rabbit, what's the evidence for this kind of thing? If you tag, I'm not sure exactly how to do this, with gold particles, you can tag these molecules and image where they are, and you can certainly see that there's a concentration of them in a rabbit right at the surface. And there will be some gross idealization during this talk, so this is probably the first step of that. This mucus-rich region is really the glycocalyx. For a long time it was called a mucin layer, and there was some I think it was rabbit evidence to think that there was, you know, on micron level or more mucus there, but certainly people do, it's not considered to be a really a separate layer these days in humans, I would say. That seems to be the consensus. And it's a few microns thick. I think only in the last decade or a little more do we have reliable measurements, courtesy of Ewan and others, about that thickness. There are numbers in the literature as high as 40 microns, which would be like a flood. You'd be like watching rain fall down the window if it was really that thick. So it's really just a few microns thick. 5 is probably an upper end for most of the time. And then there's a floating lipid layer, which you've seen some images earlier. I'm going to show you some more. That's getting to be of increasing interest to us and to the eye community, and its relationship to preventing evaporation and preserving the tear film. So that's certainly of interest. There are many other things that could be and should be of interest to the eye community, perhaps, but that's one important one now. And there's been quite a bit of discussion earlier about the composition of the lipid layer, how much of it is surfactants, really, how much of it is other things like more like hydrocarbons or oil really floating on the front of the tear film. Okay, oh, so one thing I wanted to say is that in this, there should be some bullets here. So in this role of preventing evaporation, if the aqueous part, if water evaporates from the tear film fast, it leaves behind everything else. And if you lose a lot of it, then you can be much more salty, for example. So that is thought to be a very important mechanism in dry eye for the irritation and damage that results down the road. Right? So you get this chronic saltiness that's supposed to be bad for the surface of your eye. And so we'll see a little bit of attempts to model that later today, or later in this talk. So there's a lot of ingredients around. So we can start with, there's surface tension wants to flatten things. I'm really not going to have any motion from lids. So Tom talked a lot about driving fluid flow from the lids, but I'm not going to have any of that today. I think so. You saw some introduction to the dynamics of the lipid layer. And I'll show you some more images of that. And to me, this is a very complicated question. And now that Ewan's got microscopes there, it's one of these situations where you should be careful what you wish for in terms of data. So a view that is I'm going to take a view of a de-wetting problem and see where that gets us. An initial attempt today. How does this relate? And so this, I also want to tie in breakup, which is also known as film rupture, depending on the community. And there's a number of ways you can take that. For some reason the mucus layer or the mucus region on the or the surface of the eye is non-wetting, there's one kind of approach you might take. If it seems healthy and wetting, then you might take a different approach. So I'm going to emphasize this one today. Just getting a healthy eye, is a healthy surface, is seems like a good enough challenge at the moment. I'm going to introduce a variable for the saltiness of tears. It's really everything that might induce flow out of the eye surface. So it's not one species. It's lumping a bunch of things together and calling it a concentration. So, okay. And I'm not going to get to this today, actually. So we'll just skip that. Okay. So I'm going to simplify the tear fluid. It's known to be shear thinning, not terribly so. So it might go maybe a factor of 10 or a little more for dry eye and a little less for healthy tears. The elasticity of tears, it appears to me it's mostly from the lipid layer if it's there. It's very small. So if you try to use standard measurement techniques, it's very hard to get any reliable number out. So above 32C. So it depends on the temperature. And usually in an eye, it's above that temp. So I'm going to make the surface of the tear film a flat wall. That's a big simplification, and put some boundary conditions there. There will be some van der Waals terms to try to capture wetting. So that's the effect of that glycocalyx. So I'm going to do more than this. So this is wrong, actually. So I copied this from the wrong place. So this is, we're going to have more general boundary conditions. The simplest thing you can do is just make a boundary condition. We're going to do more than that. And so I'm going to try to fit evaporation rates in a certain way, which I'll elaborate on. I'm going to use about so that your eye opens about a centimeter in the vertical direction. That's going to be my characteristic scale is half that. So I'm trying to plug all these results into open eye shapes. That's going to be my goal eventually. And the typical thickness I'm using is often going to be 5 microns. It might also be smaller. So you'll see that's the most it's going to be. If I use this, the ratio of length scales is quite small, so thin films are a pretty safe thing to use here. Okay, so I want to tell you about something old a little bit. So this is for a few minutes. So what I want to show you is a computation with it has the absolute minimal amount of physics or chemistry in it, which is really no chemistry. And I want to show you computations on the eye-shaped domain and what they can do. So I'm trying to convince you that you can get something useful out of this thin film approach to the eye. And then we'll go into the notebook. So if you wanted to see what's going on in the front of the eye, how would you do it? You can put particles in and try to watch the particles. So someone named David Morris, who's a pretty noted ophthalmologist, put lamp black in his eye. So lamp black is very fine soot. And so he then used a soot lamp to see where it goes. So these days we get in trouble if we try to do that, but 40 years ago we just did it. So he watched that and he could see that, so the temple is over here and the nose is over here. He could see that the particles would go over the top or around the bottom. More recently, we used fluorescein, which is this salt that you put it in your eye, and I'll wager just about everybody here has had it used when they, I guess they call it a tear scope. When you go to the eye doctor and they put in this salt and they dilate your eyes and then they make you sit in a room and then they shine this yellow light on it later and they look at a tear film. And when they dilate your eyes, they also look inside. But anyway, they use this tear scope to image. So this is one way to do it. So I'm going to show you a movie of, I think it's safe to say it's your eye. So I won't get in trouble for exposing the identity of the subject. So So there's a blink here. There's not too much tear fungus. It's not very bright. But if you watch over here by the tempo, you're going to see something happen. So I'll show you one more time. So I'll tell you what's happening before I show you. So the lacrimal gland is up here. There are holes near the nose, the puncta, that where the aqueous part of the tear film goes down and drains in your sinuses. So fluid comes in here, goes out over here, it's got to get around somehow. Ewan doesn't have a lot of tears, so that most of the fluid is really right by the lids. And you're going to see when it gets bright, there's more water coming in, which is lowering the concentration, and in this regime, that means brighter. So you can see it come in and it goes, splits and goes both ways, and then a blink happens. So I want to show you briefly a computation that Kara did while she was a grad student that captures some of that. So I know some of you have seen this before, many of you have not seen it before. So if you've seen it before, just try to hang on. So this is a lubrication approximation in two dimensions, Cartesian coordinates. It has surface tension. And it has, I'm not going to use gravity at all, so I should have probably removed that. But we're going to be on an ice-shaped domain, which is captured. We fit the boundary from a digital photo. And we're going to specify a thickness all the way around. And we're going to specify how much fluid comes in at the boundary and out. So that's a flux. So the tempo is reversed. It's over here in this plot. The nose will be over here. So there's fluid coming in, which is a negative flux here, and there's positive flux out at these two holes near your nose. They're time independent. So it's a simplified situation. There isn't a surfactant buried in here, but it's really simplified. It's tangentially immobile. So you got a 12 here. So that's the entire effect of chemistry there, is that number. So anyway, so if we do a calculation here, if you plot the thickness, it's relatively thin in the middle. If we're above, I think it's 3 microns, then you're in this maroon color. And we have fluid pushing in from the lacrimal glands, or from the flux, really. Let's not get too carried away. But there's a flux in here. It's pushing, it's thicker in this region here. And it's thinner over here where fluid goes out. Where does the fluid go? These little arrows indicate direction only. Gray means there's little flux. White means there's a lot of flux. The fluid comes in. Some goes this way. Some goes this way. And it goes out over here. So I'm trying to convince you that lubrication theory has some hope of doing some things right here. I view that as one case that does that. One interesting thing mathematically, and I forgot the reference, is that if you plot what the pressure field's doing, you can see that this would be, so sorry, the view keeps changing. So this is the lacrimal gland will be out here. So this is temple, nose over here. And so there's an elevated region of pressure where the tear film is flat. And then around the boundary, it's lowered because there's a meniscus, right? So it's curvature upward. That lowers the pressure. And that's why fluid would prefer to go and be by the lids in part. But during the calculation, you do get a big decrease in the pressure here. So it steepens. The pressure can steepen inside the domain. And this showed up, I think the first time people were really talking about this was Andrea Bertozzi did a paper in 94, and it's a Springer book. She did it in 1D, and this is the 2D manifestation of that, actually, that if you're sucking things out or doing things from the boundary, you can steepen the pressure inside. So something to watch out for. Some other things that we did that I'm not going to talk about really are, we also have some moving boundaries with partial blinks. So many times you only blink halfway, and we were able to compare with a fortuitous image that Ewan had of after a half blink he could do a quantitative description of the film thickness, and we had some parts of that right. Reflex tearing, we were able to show, get a pretty decent fit to some reflex tearing measurements. If you're measuring in the middle and your eye starts watering, then the water can actually get down to the middle. And recently we've done a little bit of thermal modeling to capture how cooling is observed on the ocular surface. So anyway, so just a few other things. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is, so when I started doing these things, I was always thinking about global situations, like the eye shape or the entire width of the eye. And I think I'm following the data now, and the data is getting smaller and smaller scale. So this is really trying to get more in that direction at the moment in this talk. So what I want to do is talk about leveling for a minute first, which is going to seem really elementary, We're going to linearize a lubrication problem. This is dimensional. You'll see why I want to do that in a minute. So if you linearize around the average film thickness, say a few microns, and look at the linear problem, it's easy to solve by separation of variables or whatever you like. So you have a wave number that's 2 pi over the wavelength, and you've got this time decay that's really got a fourth power of the wavelength around. So I just want to remind you about the consequences of this for this problem. Okay, so the half-life for that is going to have the wavelength in the numerator and the thickness in the denominator, right, into a power. So if I plot this, then the half-life is how long does it take to get to half the original amplitude. So if I do this for as a function of wavelength for different d's, then you can see that there's many orders of magnitude here, right? So at about a millimeter wavelength for the disturbance, which is about the spacing of the holes where the meibum comes out of your eyelids, so the lipids get supplied at about millimeter spacing, right? The time decay for that's around a second. If you have a disturbance that's more like half a centimeter over here, then we're talking on the order of 100 seconds or more, so it's much longer. 5 centimeters is more like half the opening of your eye, right? So if you have something, a disturbance on that wavelength, you're not going to be able to wait long enough for that to die out. You're going to blink long before that. So there's this wide range of decay going on. So if you did that as a function of d, then you can, it's a similar situation. Just have orders of magnitude variation in how long it takes stuff to go away. If I decide to do like a Gaussian dent, watch how that disappears. Then this case is non-dimensional now. This is that S that was showed up earlier. So I wanted to compare with one earlier result with Miller et al. That was looking at a 6-micron film. And the standard deviation here is non-dimensional is 0.025. So this width is close. The width of the whole Gaussian is close to this meibomian spacing. So if I were to compare the results in that paper, they're about 500 times different. So they're somehow there was something was awry there. I don't know if there was a coefficient wrong or something, but anyway, this it takes it's this. I guess I would say this paper is overestimating the effect of the average surface tension to flatten that surface. That's what I want to say. Now, so there's still something. So this dies out. So at a second, we still got 20% dent in the surface, right? So this is a really big valley, if you want. It's about 3/4 of the thickness down. But in a second, you're back to 20% down. Why do you care? Well, if you're evaporating, while this is supposed to be going on, you're getting thinner. If you're getting thinner, things are less mobile because of the H-cube term. So you can freeze in features. It might have happened earlier. Those might be places where you actually break up first, right? That's one thing that can happen, right? Okay, so my habit at the moment of doing evaporation is to do things by, I have a wetting term, it's a van der Waals term, so that prevents getting to H of zero. And there is sort of a, it starts with kinetic theory and you keep putting band-aids on. That's one way to do this. So I pick K bar and E to match experimental thinning rates. Then I have this wetting term around that prevents complete breakup. This is faking the glycocalyx. And so this works well for me to be able to fit experimental data. That's the virtue of it. And if I start with a 3.5-micron film and work out the numbers to get thinning rates like I want, the thinning rates I'm thinking about generally are will either be around 2.5 microns a minute or 10. 10's really fast. Those numbers came out of distributions of measurements in at Ohio State with Ewan and Jason Nichols. Okay, so if I put on a dent here, again, the standard deviation is about the width of a, or the standard deviation is smaller than the spacing of the orifices, but it works out that the Gaussian is similar to that spacing. So the valley initially comes up, which is hard to see here, but the average film thickness is going down because we're losing water, right? So as it goes down, this thing gets preserved. It doesn't, once you get down far enough, it doesn't really do much of anything. And that touches down first and widens, so the hole gets bigger. So that's this is a toy problem, but I'm trying to illustrate how that kind of feature might hang around and actually be something that matters later in an observation. Okay. So now what I want to do is I want to try to go take baby steps toward getting toward experiments. So what I want to do first is I want to put in a surfactant, and I'm going to show you some experiments first to remind you. Some of this is going to look familiar. I'm going to try to build in the lipid layer first as just a surfactant, see what happens. Okay, so I'm going to show you a film of a blink. This is a this is interferometry in a lipid layer from Ewan's lab, and the variations in grayscale are indicating thickness. And there's a blink, and then you can see this bright thing happen. And one thing you'll see is that certainly everything is moving up, right? That's against gravity, and I think it's I think most people in this room would accept that that's a surfactant-driven flow. And so. Right. Now, there's other things around, but that's going on. So this bright thing that happened there was there was a bubble, and the bubble burst. So that our interpretation of that is that when it burst, there was extra lipids there that could lower the surface tension, and you got a background gradient that's pulling the whole thing up. So it's like surfactant spreading in a background flow. Right. So this is something that was in Harvey Williams and Oliver Jensen worked on this a while ago. Omar has worked on many surfactant spreading problems, but the downstream side of this thing has very, very complicated feathery looking features, which are very reminiscent of surfactant spreading. The front's got this sort of V shape. Okay, so what you have been doing lately is zooming in on small regions of this lipid. So we're going to attempt to do that. Berger and Corson certainly talked about a surfactant-driven framework there. Experimental connections have been made by Ewan and by Owens and Phillips, and theoretically there's also a fit by Jones et al. I think I said all this. So, certainly we discussed last time that this repeatability of those lipid patterns is something that's intriguing for everybody. All right, so we saw these just a little bit ago. So what happens in this sequence, right, is that something happens in the lipid layer first. Nothing's happening there, but as time goes on, you start to see features that correspond to these what looks like holes in the lipid layer. And this was this space here was about half a millimeter, or was it a millimeter? 5 millimeters? It's not five. This is 2 millimeters.
4.5 millimeters.
4.5 millimeters there. So that's low magnification. And then a little while later, you definitely got dark spots. In this regime with fluorescein, it means the tear film got thin, and then that makes the concentration go up, because if it's from evaporation, and that quenches the fluorescence of this salt inside the film. So the concentration goes up, fluorescein goes down, it looks dark, and that's the rationale for interpreting that. All right. So the thought is, there's not much lipid here, probably very little, which makes it look dark. Increased evaporation happens there, which loses water, which makes that concentration go up and makes it dark. Okay. So I'm going to try a surfactant model. First of all, if I toy with a surfactant, what do I get to make get features like I was talking about before that might cause breakup? Okay, so skipping all the, I'll tell you what's in here from the lubrication theory. So here's the thin film equation. U bar has a, it's sort of circuitous, but there is a PX here and there's an HX there, so all your derivatives are showing up through this chain of variables. And, and then there's an evaporation term, so if J is positive, H goes down. And there's also a term here that's if C, the osmolarity inside the film is higher than 1, then this number is positive, and that's supplying water via osmosis from the ocular surface. So the derivation of this relies on really a very slight modification of Jensen and Grotberg's approach for solute transport inside a film, and this comes from the boundary condition. So, okay. So there's solute transport here, so that means osmolarity, and these same suspects show up from here to conserve mass. So here's your evaporative flux again. So I'm putting in the lipid layer as a, we're going to transport surfactant around, and we're going to, I'm going to say, you know, as there's a linear modification of the evaporation rate for the surfactant. So I, this is the simplest thing I can possibly think of to affect the evaporation rate based on how much surfactant is there. Right. So we'll see if there are some limitations to that. Okay, so that's the effect of the lipid layer on evaporation, that term right there. And, right, okay, so there's a bunch of parameters. The main thing I would think about is we're having, talking about 3.5 micron film. Okay. Are you, so there's the, so the, just a bit more about this evaporation, what the constitutive relation is really is that the mass flux is proportional to, it's modified by the pressure at the free surface. It's really compared to vapor pressure outside, but that's subtracted out. The temperature compared to the outside temperature and this concentration of surfactant at the surface. All those things are affecting the evaporation rate. So you can wonder if there's equilibrium or not. If you start with a flat, spatially uniform solution, then you're going to have H times C is 1. You have to balance what leaves the top and what comes in at the bottom to get something time independent. And you can solve that. So if you had no osmosis, for so this you have to work hard. This is a quartic. If you set PC to 0, if nothing comes in from osmosis, and you get a slight modification of what a JF and Holmesy have had before, if without any surfactant effect, then it's just delta A to the 1/3 is where the film stops, right, due to wetting. Okay, so I've put in this van der Waals term, so I stop. If I add surfactant, then I get some modification of that thickness. And, right, okay. Now, if there's osmosis going on, you may not reach that equilibrium, so you can stop earlier because of that supply. Okay. Oops. All right, so I'll just show you some, try to get you oriented with some basic plots here first. So time's coming out this way, space in this direction, there's just, there's a dimple in the middle here, with again this spacing of about the meibomian orifices. We have a 10% bump in gamma in the middle in the surfactant concentration, and H times C is 1, so C is going to be 1 over that. Okay, so so the thing hangs on barely. That's probably the short answer for this calculation. It actually touches down first there, but not by a lot. And so there's no osmosis here, so that tear film, that film thickness is going down because you're losing water. So the concentration of salt has to go up, and you see that here. So time's going increasing this way. As time goes on, then the concentration goes way up because we're stopping this thing dimensionally we're stopping at about 200 nanometers and or so. And so that's the change in thickness is something around 15 by the time you get to that time. Okay. For the surfactant, this is really kind of typical of all these calculations. So the initial time is here, time increases this way. So initially there's a spike. Notice the scale, this is not a huge spike. And it flattens pretty fast. So you get down to pretty gentle variation pretty rapidly. That seems to be a hallmark of this kind of model. And there's some funny little dynamics later as when you get down to where you're reaching this equilibrium thickness where it shuts off the evaporation. These don't seem terribly significant to me. So if I switch to panel plots, I'm looking at, rather than a 3D plot at these things, you can see H on the left, the evaporation on the right as a function of space, and each of these things, each row is a different time. So H is decreasing here. Notice the scale keeps getting smaller. Once we get down to this thickness that's around 0.06 or something, I think, then the evaporation is essentially zero. So you touch down here, then this thing is starting to widen, and that region where you've got zero is widening. So that's the sort of basic picture for H and the evaporation rate. This is no osmosis. And there are some funny dynamics where osmosis can make C sort of wiggle around a little bit, and it's not clear how significant that is. In any, what's really significant in the concentration plots is look at the scale here with no osmosis. It's really getting bigger. So that's the mostly where the news is there. Okay, so I'm just going to skip this one for now. Okay, so if so, what if I watch the minimum and maximum values of the tear film thickness and the concentration? I'm going to do that for different values of osmosis. So this has osmosis, this doesn't. This number comes from a subject at Ohio State measuring what the thickness did as a function of time and choosing a resistance to flow through the epithelium that matched that. So that's where that comes from, that number. So this kind of a so this is really a non-dimensional permeability from the cornea, if you want. And one source for how you might get those kind of things is Staten Weissman's book from 92, which they take pieces of cornea or parts of the cornea and they put it in a osmotic chamber, I guess. They have one concentration on one side, one on another, and they watch what happens to this piece of tissue. So some poor animal had to give up its ghost for that. Okay, so so what tends to happen, I would say, is, so first of all, you can see that the maximum thickness is going down, and so is the minimum thickness. It comes up a little bit, and they sort of get, once the tear film starts to drop, it doesn't really change that much, the relative sizes. So things are happening too fast here for surface tension to flatten it out, right? Okay, and it's taking about a minute. At this rate. So this is 3.5 micron film and 2.5 microns per minute thinning rate. So concentration goes way up and the maximum is a bit higher than the minimum. Fine. Okay, so one thing that seems to happen here is that, again, you can see H coming up. H does not go down nearly as far, and you can see that this difference in H persists. Things flattened out down here to that minimum thickness where everything's shut off. So we waited a really long time for that. But this concentration really kind of merges here when you've got osmolarity. So you're able to supply fluid water to make up, to get rid of the concentration difference, basically. So the concentration differences tend to stick around when you don't have much or no osmosis, and the tear film thickness seems to stick around, but the concentration difference goes away if you have osmosis. So that seems to be one thing about that. I just wanted to, this is a bit cluttered, but I'd like to try to convince you that beta is doing something, so I'm going to vary beta here. In the top row, it's 0 or a tenth. They look very, very similar. It's not doing a whole lot. When you go down to either row here on the bottom, there is your half or 0.9. Then you see a significant difference. You can see the scales change on the plot in both cases. So once you get certainly a half or above, then you got a significant effect. So tenth, not much. Okay. Right. So okay. So here I want to try to now put a disturbance on. I want to have a flat initial H and C. I want to put a bump in gamma. So I'm trying to get close to the situation now. If I think that, remember we were looking at these simultaneous fluorescence and lipid images, looked like nothing was going on the thickness side with the fluorescein, but something was happening on the lipid. So now I'm going to try to plug that in this model and see what happens. Okay, so the H and C are flat. There is a 50% bump in gamma in the middle here, with this Gaussian profile. What happens? Right? Increased gamma means lowered surface tension. Surface tension or Marangoni effect pulls fluid out of here and makes a dent. And because it's thinning with evaporation, the scale is changing, right? It's getting smaller. There is osmosis so that it doesn't get too much thinner. And the concentration goes up because there's increased evaporation because, well, from conservation, I'll say it that way. Okay, so, so this thing is getting down to touch first, and the concentration is higher in the middle. right? That's Marangoni driven. And hang on, sir. Right. So if I do, I can also up the thinning rate. So I apologize for repeating this slide, but I really wanted to point out is I can adjust that overall rate by adjusting this number in the denominator here. It's really large. H is around 1 or less. So that really dominates. And so if I do the calculation again here with an increased evaporation rate of 10 microns a minute, things are just happening a lot faster. But again, the situation where we're freezing in the Marangoni effect, basically. Now, if I was, so obviously, why don't I reverse gamma to a half and see what happens there? In this model, if I do that, you pull fluid in and you get a bump in H there. So naively piling a lot of surfactant and doing a flat surface here, the surface is mobile. It's really mobile, I think too mobile. And this model alone won't get it, I don't think. If you play with having an initial dip in H and bumps in gamma, you can still get it to work out. But that's sort of toying around, I would say. So I'm a little pessimistic about this model at this time, that it's not, doesn't automatically do, it's too simple for the lipid layer. It doesn't seem to do the right thing. Okay, so, oh yeah, I think I just said all that, actually. So we certainly need some more physics here. And I have just a couple minutes remaining, so I'll try to say something useful in a few minutes. So we need more physics, I think, and one of them is we have this the lipid layer is very thin, but it's very viscous. So some measurements for it, for viscosity, put it around 10,000 times water, 1,000 to 10,000 times water. So it's a lot more viscous. So even though it's thin, it might really slow things down, potentially, have an effect. So I'm going to try to tell you just some initial attempts at trying to put in this second layer. Okay. All right. So, I wanted to show you some. So I want to go back and show you just a few more of these images of the lipid layer from the microscope. So Ewan described how he has these tiny spots that are 0.2 millimeter in diameter. And those are really what we're using for a guide to try to get something. So I showed you the movie. All right. So, this is 0.2 millimeters across. This is contrast enhanced on this side. Darker is thinner, lighter is thicker. And you can see that there's, in this particular subject, it's not very uniform. In some, it's very uniform and have chunks floating around like Ewan showed earlier. Some subjects, you have these little disks or spots, these dark spots appear to be something like 20 nanometers or less in thickness. They can have funny shapes. They're not always circular. They're a lot like DPPC images. They get these funny little flower shapes. So they can get to be more, as time goes on, you can get more bright surrounded by more of these spots. So different things happen in different subjects. So in this, and it's hard to get true time sequences because of the issues of getting clear images out of such a difficult situation. But so sometimes we think that this is like de-wetting. You have these increasing amounts of dark spots, and you're pulling back to thicker regions. So that's one thing that can happen. This is probably a better lipid layer in that there's much more sort of diffuse and brighter areas. And there seems to be something that looks sort of like a chunk here or like a small mountain ridge. That is not, I don't think that's Newtonian, because it's not round and flattening, or it's not, it's just, it has edges, it looks like. So how can that be Newtonian? And again, so here's, this is, I think we can call this Italy, if I'm not mistaken. So Italy here, this does coarsen, it does, this tip of the boot, if you wait, there's another image a little after this where it pulls back, but it's pretty slow. And it's a lot of, it just doesn't look Newtonian because it's very not smooth at all. So, oh yeah, yeah, there, yeah. Yeah, there's, yeah, so I'm not really talking at all. It is, yeah, there could be stuff going on underneath. So I'm, yeah. Okay, so, right. So I'm throwing away a lot here. Basically, I want to get to two layers. I'm going to have Van der Waals terms around. So I'm going to try to capture, this is not terribly new to do de-wetting. I'm going to try to show you what's a little bit different about this case. Okay, and I'm not going to have any evaporation yet in a two-layer, no osmolarity yet. So, I think there's a lot of de-wetting work out there. Craster and Matar's 09 paper is a great source for that, I think. It's been very helpful for me. So much of that work has two layers that are dominated by shear, right? There's this very thin layer that might be different. So we think it is. So I'll get to that in a second. So we think of these, there's a combined thickness H that has the aqueous and lipid thicknesses in it. A typical way to design terms here for the dewetting would be to have equal and opposite terms here from H2, a total thickness and an aqueous thickness, right? Okay, so in the lipid layer, this is teeny. It's a lot smaller, a couple of orders of magnitude smaller, so we expect these terms to win, right? And so, if these two terms here, I'm going to add short range forces, which in some way is cheating, but I'm not sure how else to go about it, actually. So in those previous ones, with shear, you can get these to work out so you actually get these layers to stop. But if I drop them all because they're small, because of the lipid layer, then I need something else. And to me, it's not obvious yet what that should be. If I had evaporation, I would keep this term, but I'm not going to keep it right now because I don't have it. So we're going to have an extensional layer in this upper floating layer. I know Omar's got a paper out in O2. Is that with Warner? I'm not sure if that was Warner. Yeah. And also a group at Oxford has done something similar, but with this opening in combination with opening like Tom talked about earlier. The 09 is a thesis, and the 12 should be submitted any time. So it's not really out there for you, so I apologize for that. Okay, so I turned the crank on lubrication theory, which is a significant crank in this case. There's a aqueous thickness, lipid thickness. This is the velocity field inside the aqueous. I've got van der Waals terms showing up with this H2 in it only. And extensional terms contributing to pressure, and this PDE that has no time derivative is what's going to tell us what the velocity field in the upper layer is. So this is this is extensional. Okay. So it is a bit complicated, I admit. But I have to solve this equation, plus this one, and then these things are all auxiliary variables that I think make it easier to see, but maybe. Okay. So. I'm going to start out, I want to show you some calculations with 3.5 micron aqueous, 140 nanometer average thickness, which is a bit high for the lipid layer here. I'm going to divide up the tear film surface tension to be about 40% on the upper surface. So that's about 20, it's roughly, 18 millinewtons per meter. Lipid aqueous, 27. So I can find a reference around for this, which I neglected to put here for the 18 anyway. Okay, so and we're going to have a quarter or a fifth for how much thinner the lipid layer gets before the short range takes over and stabilizes it. So I'm going to go down to the order of maybe 35 or less nanometers in all these calculations. So what happens? So in this case, you remember I have only van der Waals terms and an extensional flow in the top. If I do one of these waterfall plots, so I got the aqueous thickness here, time coming out, and space dimension here, there's a lot of seconds here where there's a perturbation to the aqueous thickness. It's kind of complicated looking, but it's not very big, only about 5%. So this is really what's coming about from the relative sizes of the van der Waals terms, and this is using what I would say is a naive version from Israel Akvili's book. And So if I look at what the lipid layer is doing, it will de-wet. Basically, it gets a valley, it gets flat in the middle, and then you get ridges on either side. These thicknesses are really encouraging because this will go up to, if I have a bump, like a big bump in the lipid layer, it could be 100 nanometers or more, 200 easily, depending on the situation. So that the dimensions that way are working great. I'm going to up this van der Waals term by a factor of 25 to Oh, sorry. So you can see that I'm. So this scale is for the. This is using a FIS. So the right-hand scale is for the lipid thickness. So you can see it about doubles, and goes down to about a fifth. Those are really good ranges for this. So blue is what's happening in the aqueous layer, not much, which is on this scale. Okay. So what I'm going to do is. I don't think we need that. So what I wanted to do briefly is mention if I want to increase these van der Waals terms to get in a reasonable time range. So if I multiply them by about 25, then I'm about 5 times 10 to the minus 19 for the sizes of these, which I think are pretty, still very reasonable size van der Waals terms. Okay, but that's going to, and the relative sizes are the same. So it's still going to go down to about a quarter or a fifth. So I'm going to put on a small dent in H2. H1 is flat. Turn it on, let it go. And it turns out that half the thickness is enough to make it go down to start to de-wet, and you start to generate these patterns of bumps, basically bumps of the lipid layer. So, right. So how important is this compared to those images? I don't know yet. This is getting in the notebook where it's like last week, so I don't really know enough to tell you about the interpretation for those dynamics yet. And I have some more situations. If I go down to 2 microns for the aqueous, the pattern develops more slowly. The extent seems similar, but the pattern is less bumps in the same width, roughly. I had some more to talk about, but I'm going to skip that because I'm already going too long. I put surfactant in, and it seems to promote that development of these bumps a bit. And that's all I'll say about it. And right. So I guess what we were trying to do is lately here is just to build in more chemistry and physics to try to capture some of these complicated lipid images that are in reality. So if there's any questions, I'll be happy to take them.